Very good. So one of the things that I say about the Screwtape Letter is when I'm teaching it, when I'm introducing it to sophomores, I tell them about how it is that when the Twins are playing a series, let's say they're playing against Cleveland, Cleveland is going to have people in the stands before the Indians come into town. Well, the team formerly known as the Indians. Before the Indians come into town, Cleveland sends scouts ahead, and they are going to be looking at how Minnesota is playing. How are they pitching? How are they hitting? What are they doing well? What are they doing badly? And they write up a report, and they send that back to Cleveland. So when the Indians come into town, they have a strategy based on those strengths and weaknesses. A lot of the students know that. But they don't know is that the Twins have two scouts up in the stands, and they are writing a report as if they were writing to somebody out of town. They're writing a report as if they were writing to Cleveland or the Yankees or whatnot, only instead that report goes to the front office. So in other words, the Twins pay people to scout themselves. And the great thing about that report is, what do you look like to the enemy? What do you look like to a team that's coming into town to play you? It is very difficult, as it were, to see yourself. And that's the great thing about the Screwtape Letters. This is what you look like to an enemy intelligence. This is what you look like to an evil spirit who is trying to lead your soul astray. Because your sense of yourself is going to be very different from the sense of self that an evil spirit or a good spirit would have about you. Right? Especially when you're younger. You know, when you're a teen, when you're in high school, your life is about your friendships. Your life is about how things are going in your classes. Your life is about your activities. Your life is about your sports. Eventually, you develop this, well, how else can you call it? A kind of resume self, right? There's the way that you make yourself look to a college, right? What's my GPA? What service things am I doing? What achievements do I have? Like I'm in honor society or student government, right? There's your resume self. Those are kind of easy ways of thinking about yourself, right? Who am I to my friends? Who am I in my emotional life? Who am I in terms of my grade point average and my academic performance? But the helpful thing about the Screwtape Letters is to recognize that an evil spirit doesn't care about any of that. That is all a bunch of blah, blah, blah to him. There's a great moment in the Screwtape Letters, letter number 6, where he talks about, consider your patient as a series of concentric circles with will at the center, intellect, and then British English, he says fantasy, we would say imagination. All folks are going to have some amount of good qualities and bad qualities. He talks about benevolence and malice, right? Goodwill, bad will. And as much as possible, what you want to do is shove all the bad qualities inward and push all the good qualities outward. Okay? So if you take something like generosity, right? You can know what generosity is. You can sit there and explain it to people. You can have it in your imagination. You can have all these, let's say definition. You can have all these beautiful images, let's say, of generosity. You can have these, you know, pictures of Mother Teresa and inspiring examples you got from Catholic grade school, right? You can explain it. You can give images of it. But Screwtape points out, unless the person is choosing to be generous over and over again, nothing's happening. Right? What makes you a good person is not what you know, it's not what you imagine, it's what you choose to do over and over and over and over again. And generally, this is not the way we think about ourselves. In fact, when you run into this in Lewis, think of your man as a series of concentric circles. I think that's exactly the kind of thing that when you pick up, what? What? This is the way that devils talk? What? Well, of course, because what's at the center for a devil? What you choose. Not what you feel, not what you think, not what you dream, not what you aspire to. For For devil, that's all noise. What he cares about is your choices. And if you look at letter 12, if you recall, it's one of the... Hey, do any of you, you got your books? Look at that last paragraph on letter 12. This is the paragraph where he talks about how it is that, you know, like all young tempters, you want to get this guy into acts of splendid wickedness, right? You want to get grandly wicked acts. But murder is no better than cards if cards will do the trick. The strategy is that you are able to get this guy cumulatively from smaller sins to bigger sins. The safest road to hell is the gradual one. No turnings, no signposts, right? He doesn't, soft road underfoot. He doesn't know what's happening. Okay? So one of the things, again, that I think the Screwtape Letters is very helpful for helping us understand in terms of how we look to the enemy, not just how the will is central to who we are, but the cumulative effect of the choices that we make. Okay? One of the things that I will tell students, if the devil is subtle, the devil is not easy to detect. If you think of him as some kind of like he's going to come out from the corner of an alley or behind a tree in a raincoat. I got a bottle of booze and some cigarettes. I'll teach you how to sin, right? If that's your, how would the devil be so successful if he was sort of that obvious? If you think of diabolic temptations, you know, sell meth, rob a bank. Yes, that is what he's going to tell upscale suburban teenagers. Sell meth, rob a bank. No. He is going to appeal to whatever your moral vulnerabilities are at whatever spot you're at. So one of the questions that I got, this is why it's invaluable getting student input, because they ask you these things. Well, when I want to blow off my homework, is that the devil's? The devil tempting me to blow off my homework? Of course, the first response is, I think you can come up with that idea all by yourself. Okay? I don't think you need some kind of evil spirit to say, it would have never occurred to me to blow off my homework if it were not for a spirit from below. No, you can come up with that all by yourself. But second, again, you're thinking of the devil in terms of like simple strategies. Like, my parents want me to do homework, I blow it off. My devil doesn't want me to follow my parents, so this is diabolic. No. What, I think it's in letter 19, where he's talking about being in love, whether being in love is good or bad. And he says, can't you see that there's no answer to that question? All that matters is what will move a particular patient with a particular state of mind, in particular circumstances, nearer to the enemy or nearer to us. That's all that matters. So if blowing off your homework is something that really fits a larger picture of irresponsibility, it fits a larger picture of you basically not following what you need to be doing to grow and mature, then great, he's going to tempt you to blow off your homework. But if doing your homework is something that he can see will fit in to a plan that you have for yourself, where achievement, power, status, and the goods of the world, that is what's going to be most important to you. And by all means, he wants you to do your homework. By all means, he wants you to do your homework. Letter 28, toward the end, this is a letter that I find particularly disturbing because it talks about middle-aged adversity and middle-aged prosperity. You know, it wasn't long ago that I felt like I was talking about like people in middle age, like people out there somewhere, and I appear to have closed the gap. But he will, Screwtape will talk about how it is in the case of middle-aged prosperity. This is a particularly haunting line to me. He thinks that he is, the man who is successful, the person who is successful in middle age, he thinks he has found his place in the world, when in fact the world has found its place in him. Okay? So in other words, you know, when you achieve, when you, as it were, sort of look at your life and say, aha, I'm here, I've arrived, that's going to be at some point in your 40s or 50s. And that, and what does that mean? That you've gotten kind of the money, the status, the recognition, the self-respect. It's kind of all come together for you. Well, how easy it is for those things to simply be the highest goods, especially if you've succeeded very well. You know, whatever your profession is, whatever your achievements are, that you're able to look at yourself and say, you know what? I have the things that everybody else respects. I have the things that everybody else wants. Throughout the Screwtape Letters, you see this phrase, worldliness, right? It's introduced in letter 5 when he's talking about the war. You would think the devils would like war. They'd like all the explosions and the killing and so on. And Screwtape says, no. First, we don't want people thinking about their death. That's not good. We don't want them going to their death prepared. We don't want people turning to the enemy in prayer. That happens a little too often in war for them to be comfortable. And you even have people that even if they don't turn to God, they get these notions of like self-sacrifice and love of country. Right, again, that's no good because a lot of times they can get partial credit for that from God, and we don't want that either. Okay, so taking that first one, though, about preparation for death, it's in that context that he talks about our best ally is contented worldliness. Okay, so this was many years ago, in fact, before I came to Providence, I had a student ask, will our natural disasters from the devil? And it's almost like they're picturing the devil in hell with like the meteorological control board in front of them, like volcano, hurricane, typhoon, the weather brought to you from Satan. And I said, no, if your picture is that somehow natural disasters, volcanoes and all that stuff are from the devil, you know, take this letter, take letter number 5 to heart. Natural disasters, well, yeah, people die and they're injured, but that doesn't guarantee that they're morally and spiritually worse. And that's what Screwtape's after, that people are morally and spiritually worse. What happens when they're self-sacrificial and they volunteer and there they are pulling people out of the flood and, you know, helping people out of burning buildings? Boo, right? From a devil, that's no good. Better, he says, a contented worldliness. So if the devil were really just completely in charge, we might not have natural disasters at all. Let there be a chicken in every pot. Let there be a car in every garage. Let there be a roaring economy. Let there be peace and stability and prosperity. Because generally, that is going to make people less spiritual. That's what he's after. And one of the things I always feel as I'm dealing with, especially with teens, is bad horror movies, which confuses the mnemonic with the monstrous. Okay, those are different. Monsters want to eat you. Like that monster under the bed and in your closet, he wants to eat you. Right? He's not trying to corrupt you or anything. He's after you to eat you. Okay? But demons and devils, they don't just want to like chop you up into a bunch of bloody pieces. Demons and devils they're all about the inside. Are you becoming worse? Are you becoming greedy and envious and resentful and so on? It's all about that. If you aren't making people morally and spiritually worse, this is something that Screwtape insists on in letter 5. You're not doing your job. And you can't make them morally and spiritually worse all at once. That's why that long game is so important. That's why you just can't think that the devil isn't trying to corrupt you this weekend, tonight, right? You have to think of if you think about two different kinds of games, when you play poker, no hand is connected to any other hand, right? You make the best of the hand you've got. You win, you lose, you get dealt a new hand. You have to think of the devil like a chess player, where the moves that you are making 5 moves in, 10 moves in, are connected to things that you are doing 20 moves from now or 25 moves from now. So they're not short-term, they're long-term. He's not trying to corrupt you this week, this month. Again, the wonderful image at the beginning of letter 12. Think of your patient as being sort of in orbit around the enemy. And what you're trying to do is, as it were, knock him ever so slightly out of that orbit so that before he realizes it, he is no longer in orbit around the enemy, but heading out to the cold and dark of space. Right? That's what you want. You don't want him even to realize what's happening. Maybe that's a good place to pause. Again, there are so many things to talk about in the Screwtape letters. We read this with the sophomores. We read most of them. We don't read all of them. We read most of them. But I try to hit the ones that are going to be most useful for them at that point in their lives. You'd love to be able to come back to them after they've graduated or after they've actually graduated college and read the whole thing as an adult, because you're just, quite frankly, once you read as an adult, it's going to be a different book for you. When you read it at 16, there's a lot you can get out of it. But then when you read it as an adult, it's going to be a different book, because you will have experienced so much more that allows you to get more out of it. In general, those are the kind of books you want to give young people. You don't want to give young people a book that they sort of exhaust at 16, right? I've been there, done it, right? You want a book that when you pick that up again, it really is, it unfolds for you. That first reading as a 16-year-old kind of breaks the ice, but then it unfolds for you. Questions? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, to your last point, I like the part where he said, we want them to linger in nursing homes surrounded by people who lie and doctors who lie.
Yeah.
And tell them, well, you're going to live a long time when they're not. And I thought that was good. Also, I would like you to address the gluttony of delicacy.
I will. Good. In fact, that's something we just talked about recently. When people think about gluttony, usually the first thing in their mind is that kind of gluttony that Screwtape introduces with gluttony of excess. In other words, the desire to just eat too much. But gluttony is broader than that. Gluttony is the excessive desire for food. So that excessive desire could be amount. By the way, one of the things I tell them, because I'm talking to teens, generally for most of them that's not relevant. I mean, they burn off what it is that they eat, especially these big boys in season. Oh my God, if I ate like they did, then that would be gluttony. I tell them, if I ate like you boys did, that would be gluttony. But they really can just eat and eat and eat, and at their age, they burn it off. But I said, the kind of gluttony that you're vulnerable to is the kind that's being described here, where you are demanding about your food. So it's not that you eat too much. You want it a certain way. You want a certain kind of food. And if you don't get it the way you want it, you're bent out of shape. So for the patient's mother, I just want the teeniest, weeniest piece of toast, and I just want half a cup of tea. And so she demands on waitresses. She makes demands on hostesses and so on. She thinks she's being temperate because the amounts are small, but she doesn't recognize that she is putting people out. She's impatient. She's short-tempered. By the way, it was in this context, when I was teaching this, that I had a student raise his hand and say, is this what a Karen is? Isn't this a Karen? And of course, I had to laugh because Karen is now this difficult middle-aged woman. But the reason, of course, they choose the word Karen, when I went to school, there were girls named Karen. I went to school with Karens and Julies and Kimberlys and Stephanies. And now there are no Kimberlys and there are no Sharons and there are some Julies. But I tell you, you know what? 30 years from now, they're not going to talk about Karens. They're going to be at that restaurant. Oh, there's a Madison out there. There's an Emma. There's an Emma out there, right? It's going to be these names that were popular when you were kids. Now, when you're up here, they're going to be talking about that. So that's the idea. It's not the food in itself. It's the way you're treating other people. By the way, and I have to distinguish from them being delicacy from pickiness. I said, when I was, let's say, 8 years old, my idea of a diet was pizza, hamburgers, chicken, spaghetti, tacos. Those four, five things. You could just do that on a rotation, and I would have been a happy camper. And why we have to eat these other things just baffled me. Like, why are we eating other things besides these five? Okay, a lot of young kids, they're picky. But delicacy isn't just a matter of there's a narrow range of things that you like. The idea of delicacy is whatever it is that I'm getting, I want it a certain way, and if I don't, this is too hot, this is too cold, this is too sharply flavored, right? You have to be able to kind of take what you're getting. I grew up in a, you are going to take everything that served you, young man, and finish your plate. I spent hours at that, wrestling Brussels sprouts and beets and things like that. But one of the things that I'm sort of grateful for that is I was able to go to other people's houses and get served food that I didn't like, and I was able to wrestle it down because I was not allowed to do otherwise. So it served me in good stead when I went to places that I really just didn't like. Okay, lima beans. I just couldn't do the lima beans. I think I probably bailed on the lima beans, but yeah. Go ahead.
I have two things that would like you to talk about.
Sure.
The first thing is he talks about this mist around people.
There's this asphyxiating cloud.
Yeah.
And some people are permanently this is at the beginning of letter 13. One of the things that I do in class is I show them a picture of St. Anthony of the Desert. And there are all sorts of different artists that have rendered this over time. But St. Anthony was one of the early monastic figures. He's out in the desert. And these pictures of the temptations of St. Anthony, it depends which artist you got. But there's one I've been trying to track down. I thought it was Albrecht Dürer. But he's got all these little devils all over him. I mean, he's just covered in little devils the way you're covered with, like, mosquitoes in the summertime. And all these little devils are, like, they're pulling on his hair, they're pulling on his ears, they're, like, kicking him. And he just has this expression of serenity on his face. Okay? And it gives you the image of somebody who really, because of their union with God, it's like the devil throws you all these things at him, and it's almost like it bounces off. So when he talks about there are people who just seem to be permanently surrounded by this, I think it's the kind of people he's thinking of as St. Anthony. But the general idea is this. There are times that, in moments of diabolic temptation, that God is just going to drop a force field on you. He's not going to do it all the time, but there are times that he's going to give you kind of a special break or a special grace, and it's just going to make life very difficult for the devil that's after you. Yeah, so that's the idea. That did you have a second one? Or?
I did. At the end, when he gives a speech, he's quite critical. Well, I shouldn't say it. It's hard. You have to, like, think he's actually complimentary of democracy.
Yeah.
So,
wait a minute. Are you talking about? Proposes a toast?
Yeah.
Yeah. And when we.
Democracy.
Yeah. So, we don't read that sophomore year. We do that usually senior year. Some point in senior year, because we're talking about education, especially if we're talking about Alan Bloom's Closing the American Mind. That's a good thing to put in there, or with Abolition of Man at the beginning of the year. But you're right. What he's critical of is not democracy. What he's critical of is this attitude that people think is essential to democracy, which is to this belief in sort of radical equality, such that you say, nothing is better than anything else. In a way, that's when I get the 10th graders who come in, who... Right? There's no such thing as a moral law. Everybody has their own values. Everybody has their own beliefs. When you push that out, what they think they're doing is believing what you have to believe to be in a democratic society. I'm no better than anyone else. I'm not superior. I'm not. My beliefs aren't superior. You have your beliefs. I have my beliefs. We're all equal. And what they don't recognize is, in a democracy, you've got to believe that some things are better than others just for the democracy to work. But then, when you're young, you don't see that.
I was just so surprised because I felt like that could have been written yesterday.
Yes.
But some of the specifics, like what was going on in the world at that time that made him...
Well, in England, there's already this move that, remember, they are starting to move from a classical education, which you have this investment in things being traditional, that you've done them a certain way, that there are great minds and great books to read, and you're transitioning to, we should just teach people things that are useful and practical, and you don't need all that stuff. And that tends to go along, unfortunately, with the view that those things are no better than anything else. You know, so you don't need that. And that's at that same period, 1930s or 40s. I think of the way my father would describe his grandfather, so my great-grandfather. This was a guy who dropped out of school in the eighth grade because he had to work. He had to work to support his family. But he was somebody who always kept reading. He had a library. He had a personal library. He could quote, this is my great-grandfather, he could quote Goethe in German and Shakespeare in English. You know, there are a lot of college grads that can't quote Shakespeare in English and Goethe in German. But he was able to do that because he thought, just because I wasn't able to finish school doesn't mean that I'm just going to accept what I have. I want to know more. I want to be better. So that kind of outlook means you think there are some things that are better than others. Right? You don't think it's just all about I have a job, I make money, done. Go ahead.
Could I comment on teaching that that essay to seniors? And you're right, it does feel like it was written yesterday.
Yeah.
Because he's thinking about the radical democracy, where tolerance and affirmation of all ways is what we're taught. And we're taught, and young people are particularly, we're taught, we're not taught in Providence Academy, the society teacher, that virtue for me is affirming everything. What is marvelously Scrutapian demonic about this, of course, is what that does, really. It's no virtue of me affirming everybody. It's that nobody has the right to judge me.
Yeah.
And that anything I want is fine. That's how that usually plays.
Yep.
So what we, what a radical democracy as a society suggests is a virtue of tolerance and affirmation actually is a personal excuse.
The only thing I would add to that is notice the phrase that Lewis uses in there, I'm just as good as anyone else. Nobody who, at the moment you say that, you really don't believe it. Because it's so obviously false that there are people different in intellectual ability and athletic ability and social, all those things, that it ends up just being a kind of a rationalization. Slimes?
I thought also when he's saying, the easiest way to get to young people is to teach them that they can make heaven on earth.
Yep.
And I'm like, again, like it was written yesterday, we've got all these young people out there trying to make heaven on earth.
It's interesting because that very passage is where he's talking about how it is that it's harder to corrupt older people than younger people. And of course, the 16-year-old who reads that is totally counterintuitive, because what they think is, you're young, you're immature, you just want to play, you don't care about serious things, you don't care about religion, you're old, you start going to church, you think all that matters. Okay, and I tell them, the problem with your picture is, yeah, if you go to daily mass, let's say, there are a lot of these older people there, but you're not seeing all the older people who aren't in church. Or you go to, right, even when you go to your church on Sunday, yeah, there are older people there, but you're not seeing all the older people who aren't there. In fact, there are all sorts of reasons why it is, as people get into adult life, that the faith is actually harder for them. Not easier. Take my example of, again, this achieving successful person. Why do I need religion? Why do I need... I'm happy. I've got my country club membership. I've got my big house. I've got my car. I've got my high status job. What do I need that for? Okay. So if your picture is, it's hard to be religious when you're younger because you just don't take things seriously, it's easier when you're older. Only if you've made the choices that allow you to be open to religion is it easier when you're older. And that starts when you're younger. But then the second thing I point out is, look at what he's saying. His frustration with younger people is that they're impractical. He says, a song, the face of a girl, a poem, it blows our structure all away. We're trying to get them to focus on safety first and being practical. Right? There are all these things as a parent, right? Think about your major. You have a major that's going to make money, and your kid comes back, I want to be an art major. Ah! Right? Because kids don't think practically. They're thinking about, what do I feel? What feels good? What do I think would make me happy? And what Screwtape says is, for us, that's a problem. Because That, in a way, is a road to heaven. That you have a desire for happiness, and that's what you're focused on. But that's what the beatific vision is all about. That's what union with God is all about. It is going to be the fulfillment of your deepest longings. So you always have to, I think, in raising a child, have a kind of balance between these things that really are practical, that they do need to pay attention to. Hey, you're not going to be living here for the rest of your life, sweetheart. You need to think about having a job. But on the other hand, it really does need to be balanced of there are longings in your heart that you need to pay attention to. You may not be able to make a living from those longings in your heart, but you don't just want to dismiss or minimize those longings in the heart, because ultimately, and Lewis will argue this more in the essay on heaven in The Problem of Pain, ultimately those longings, which are impractical and romantic and so on, ultimately those longings are for a perfect truth, a perfect happiness. That's a fire you want to fan. You don't want to snuff that. That's a fan you want to fire. Or a fire you want to fan. Other questions, comments? This is good. Yeah. By the way, other people are allowed to ask besides. I just want to let you know. Have you delegated? This is Lions to be your spokes. Okay, go ahead.
Can you talk about the problem of prayer?
In which part?
Well, I read.
Are you talking about letter four, where he's talking
problems with prayer, and then there's the heads you win, tails I lose.
Oh, that section. Okay. I am not the reason I'm trying to recall it. We don't read that letter together. But the point that Lewis makes there, as I understand, if I'm remembering this rightly, is prayer. And there he's talking about petitionary prayer, right? You want to get the patient in the sense that it's always somehow in vain. That if you pray for something and it doesn't happen, then prayer was worthless. And if it does happen, then put it into his mind that it would have happened anyway, and why'd you bother? Remember that wherever you're talking about cooperation with God, there really are both ends matter. God wants you to pray because he wants you to see that his providence responds to what it is you're asking. But part of his providence is also that occasionally he has to tell you no. Depending on the kind of requests you make, maybe he often has to tell you no. But those are the kind of things that you look back and you say, thank God he said no. You may not say that immediately. And in fact, it may be about things that it won't be clear until you're in the hereafter why he said no. But the fact that you pray and you get it does not mean that prayer, like it would have happened anyway. That somehow your praying was part of that picture. And conversely, that you prayed and it didn't happen didn't mean the prayer was worthless. It meant you recognized that God was the source and that that you trust that when he says no, or perhaps not now, there's a reason for that. There's a great section in letter four early on where he talks about how it is that get the patient to react against the parrot-like prayer that he had when he was a kid. You're just sitting there, Our Father who art in heaven, Hail Mary, full of, right? You got a script and you run through the script. So get him to think that when he's an adult, what he does is just, it's like you make up your own prayers, you just kind of say what you feel, and, to put it very simply, you pray what you want, when you want, when you feel like doing it. And what he points out is, what we want to do is sabotage the idea that prayer demands any kind of real will and intention. And that's actually not tough to explain, because a lot of them are doing things, sports, instruments, and so on, where they recognize, I've got to do this every day, whether I like it or not, if I'm going to get good at it. I have to do these things every day. Even when I was a ninth grade garage band drummer, right? I was in band in middle school, but I dropped out because I could see in the high school they were playing big band jazz. Da 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 da, boom ba ba. No, I wanted to play rock and roll, loud and fast, the way it was meant to be played. So there I was in the band. But I knew from my formation in middle school, I had to sit there 30 minutes before, right, I started touching the rest of the drums. I had to do flam triplets and flam taps and paradiddles. Rudiments are boring. Even if you love playing drums, rudiments are boring. But the only way that you're ever going to sound good is if you do rudiments. Likewise, you can't just pray in whatever way you want, whenever you feel like it, and have that really be a helpful prayer. There has to be ways in which it's regular. You offer a morning offering whether you feel like it or not. At the end of the day, you reflect on your day. What did you do well? What did you do badly? Whether you like it or not. And that there is a script. Hopefully what happens as you get older is not that you're saying it like a parrot. Hopefully what you're doing is that you have a better idea of what the script is. Why do we say these things? And, you know, we have a script because God is merciful and he's not just going to have us make it up all the time. It's not that we can't ever pray spontaneously. But remember, that Our Father, that's a response to the request of the disciples. John's disciples taught him to pray. Lord, teach us to pray. They ask. And then he gives it to them. So things like the Our Father, the Hail Mary, the Hail Holy Queen, even something as simple as the Angel of God prayer. That is well worth, in your, you know, now that you're mature and you have life experience and you've read more and thought more, to just take those phrases and think about them. You know, that's well worthy of meditation. Other questions? Let me say one more thing about that. He talks about bodily position in prayer. I'll leave you with this anecdote. I had she was a graduate, and she told me that when she was a sophomore and they were reading the Screwtape letters, there's this line in four, you must remember what they forget, that they are animals, and what they do with their bodies affects their souls. So the position of their body in prayer matters. She told me, when I was a sophomore and I was reading that, when I was a little girl, I would kneel by my bedside and say my... But then when I was a teenager, I thought, well, I'm not like a little girl anymore. So there she is in bed, totally horizontal, under her coverlet, snug as a bug in a rug. And what are you doing when you say your night prayers? Oh my God, I'm heartily sorry, I haven't offended you, I test all my sins. Okay, when do you apologize to people lying down? So I have some kind of quarrel, some kind of misunderstanding with my wife. I hurt her feelings. Dear, I'm really sorry about what I said to you. Is that going to sell it? You're going to buy an apology at 180 degrees? you've got to at least be sitting up. You know, standing is probably better. Your position matters. And it has to do with body language. You say things with your body. And, of course, with students, it's easy to give them examples. When you were in middle school, you didn't even have to say that there was something ridiculous about what the adults were telling you. What did you do? And they all, almost in unison, you roll your eyes. Yes, starting in sixth grade, every morning you wake up early, you go to the mirror, and you exercise, because you're going to be doing a lot of eye rolling that day. And you just go back and forth, 20 times, up and down. Okay, you don't have to say anything. You don't have to say anything. You've got a gesture that pronounces condemnation on the absurdity that's being propounded to you by the grown-ups. Okay? You communicate with your body. That's part of being human. So if you're going to pray, your body should reflect what it is that you're trying to communicate. Well, in conclusion, let me just say this, that when at the very beginning, you'll notice there are these quotes. It's dedicated to Tolkien. Tolkien never knew why it was dedicated to him. And in fact, if somebody wrote a book about the devil and dedicated it to you, would that be a would that be a compliment? So we have this letter from Tolkien where he's actually a little annoyed and doesn't quite get why Lewis dedicated this book to him. But then after that, you'll notice these quotes from Thomas More and Martin Luther about the devil. The devil does not like to be flouted, jeered at, scorned, that proud spirit. That signals that what you're reading is a work of satire. satire always has a comic element to it, but it also has a serious element to it. There are all sorts of books that you could read about the devil, about how the devil works and so on. They're pretty heavy books. They're pretty dark books. They're books that are kind of difficult to get through. The great thing about the Screwtape Letters is you are really getting some insight as to how an evil spirit works, but you're getting it in a way that there's delight in it. You can read it over and over again. It's not heavy. It's not weighty. It's not dark. You know, that's a great gift of this book. And let me conclude with this. Years ago, Antonin Scalia, remember the Supreme Court justice, he was being interviewed by this New York magazine, and he talked about how they were interested in him being religious. You know, these New York journalists, they don't know many of those people, so that was kind of interesting to them. And he talked about believing in God, and he said, "And I believe in the devil too." And this reporter was so taken aback. Like you're an educator, but like you believe in the devil? You know what his response was? "What's the matter with you? Haven't you ever read the Screwtape Letters?" I think there's a reason why it is that if you were going to kind of pick one book, that's the book you would pick. Because Lewis, for 20th century and for 21st century people, the Screwtape Letters is a book that really helps the modern reader understand the reality of the devil and the reality of evil. In an accessible way, better than anything else that's out there.
I think it seemed very apropos that he dedicated to Tolkien, because Tolkien took on the devil in Lord of the Rings so incredibly powerfully.
Yeah, but that's what you'd need, wouldn't it? You'd need some kind of explanation, because if all you saw was the Screwtape Letters, a correspondence between devils, dedicated to J.R.R. Tolkien. Thanks a lot. Very good. I'm glad you got through it. Thank you.